This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello. It's Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. My name is Mark Wigmore, host of The Oasis on the New Classical FM in Toronto, and that organization presents this podcast twice weekly on the Zoomer Podcast Network. Great to be with you. Great to have you along. We live in a wild world right now. Just read any newspaper, watch the news. Sometimes we look across this country and beyond, and we wonder if there are any solutions to our multi-pronged problems and issues. And sometimes it does feel hopeful and often hopeless. And maybe, just maybe, the conversations that we put together here and offer up to you on Art at the End of the World provide a little solace. Maybe some balance to the mania. That is the hope. We call these Thursday episodes Remix, and it's a series of conversations re-released from the first season because we actually have a network and a support system this time around. So it's nice to get a fresh set of listens and ears on these great conversations. Scratch Bastid is my guest today, DJ, wildly talented producer and turntablist. Of course, he's so famous worldwide as a big club draw, but he's also been a partner with Kerner Hall on several occasions for big soft seat shows. So we'll get to DJ Scratch Bastid in just a moment. This episode sponsored by Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company working with award-winning clients, including the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and many others, redeyemedia.ca. One of Red Eye's partners is Crow's Theatre, also a sponsor, one of this country's most acclaimed arts organizations and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's Theatre creates unforgettable theater that examines and illuminates the pivotal narratives of our times. And that continues. Crowstheatre.com for info and tickets. Don't forget Secret Life of a Mother by Hannah Moscovich, and actress Maeve Beattie is on through this weekend at Streetcar Crow's Nest, and you can go and enjoy a show at Carlaw and Dundas. All right, DJ Scratch Bastid, I saw him in action the day that David Bowie passed away, and that's because his name is Paul Murphy, by the way. He put together this incredible tribute to Bowie by using his turntables to remix the track Let's Dance, the iconic 80s hit, and it was a real moment of joy and celebration on what was otherwise a pretty dark day. And it became a viral sensation. Millions saw it. Millions saw what Paul was able to do with a couple of turntables. Pretty fantastic. I'm actually going to play a little bit of it for you in a few moments. And then I caught him at Kerner Hall with DJ Jazzy Jeff, the famous Philly DJ from DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince fame. And I actually bought the tickets or got a hold of the tickets because I wanted to see Jeff, but I ended up leaving the building talking about Paul. Jeff was great, but I think I just didn't fully understand what DJ Scratch Bastid was capable of. And I'm going to talk to Paul about that friendship in just a moment. But needless to say, right then and there, I became a big fan. Paul is a three-time Scribble Jam DJ battle winner. He's Juno nominated as a producer. He tours constantly all over the world, a global ambassador and judge for Red Bull's annual three-style and freestyle DJ competition. He can kind of do it all, and he's worked within soul and reggae, but also hip-hop, classical music, and he's had big collaborations with Shad, the rapper, and a guy that I'm fairly familiar with, Buck 65, a.k.a. Rich Terfry. Rich and I worked together for years at the CBC, so Paul and I have lots to talk about under the Buck 65 umbrella. Wu-Tang Clan, Paul has worked with that group, Beastie Boys. So here we go. From DJ Scratch Bastid's kitchen table at his home and studio space in Toronto's West End, this is our conversation on Art at the End of the World Remix. You know my name. Jazz. We not playing. I put words together like magic. Everyday style.
here we are in the kitchen of Scratch Bastard. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Yeah, sounds. Just say it comfortably, and everything will work out just fine. It's kind of an East Coast twang, I think. When I was actually given the full spelling and wording of the second part of my name, but I decided to add my own little East Coast spin because that was just how I wanted to have it. So I guess it's kind of like a Boston, New York kind of bastard.
Little East Coast slang.
Exactly.
Well, I know something about where you're coming from, and I want to talk to you about it. Anyway.
Okay.
But I wanted to start by telling you a quick story.
Okay.
That I was last year, I want to say, I got an invite from my friend Dustin to go see Metallica. And
okay.
I'd never seen Metallica before. And the reason he wanted to go is because he's pretty good friends with the Beastie Boys over the years and Mixmaster Mike.
Uh-huh.
And he's been on tour with Mixmaster Mike lots of times. And so we had these nice passes, and so there we were backstage in front of, you know, 60,000-70,000 people or whatever it was, and poor Mike has to get out there in front of this metal crowd and just work those tables and try and, you know, amp this crowd up so that when Enter Sandman starts playing, everybody's kind of ready to go. And I thought, wow, you know, as a DJ, you get asked to do a lot of different types of things and create different types of music and work in different formats and all the rest of it. And you are no stranger to that. So I was curious if you've had that gig where you thought, what have I got myself into this time?
I tend to take on just about any gig that tickles my fancy. I don't know. I like being challenged, and that comes from an early time in my career, while being from Nova Scotia and being a hip hop DJ from Nova Scotia.
So there's Exhibit A.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I want to try to make this a career, or, you know, I want to get gigs, be more serious about this, I would be play in places like Andy Ganesh or, you know, Moncton, St. John. I'd play at the local bars, and some of the locals would sort of look at me like, what is this guy doing over there? And
like,
they'd still make those things. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm from here. You know, I'd bring my own gear and everything. So even from that, I really learned to enjoy the idea of, you know, proving myself or even justifying my existence, or just sort of more than for me, it was more for the art form, because I'm so passionate about DJing and DJ culture and scratching and the musicality of it all, that it means a lot to me. So if anyone challenged that, I'd be like, well, no, I think this is totally a legit thing. Check this out.
Did you feel like, okay, I got an uphill battle here just from a cultural standpoint?
To be honest, it never felt like an uphill battle as much as I just liked the challenge. And, you know, I've always kind of been an underdog. I've played basketball all my life. I would say my average team record was below 500, but like, you know, like the upsets and everything like that.
Yeah.
Come from a smaller town, still not the big town, even out there. I'm from Bedford, Nova Scotia, 20 minutes outside Halifax.
So would we call that a suburb?
Yeah, it's kind of the burbs. It's technically in the Halifax regional municipality, but, but yeah, you know, to the people in Halifax, it's still 20 minutes away or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Did, now you just played the Consumer Electronics Show, isn't it?
Yeah,
right?
CES.
So
Vegas.
That would be a good example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
A little bit off the beaten track as far as what you're used to.
Yeah, and I was at the Panasonic booth. So Panasonic make the Technics turntable, the Technics line.
Yeah.
And
Classic
line. It's like audiophile line. And they made the Technics 1200, which is the iconic DJ turntable.
Right.
Like, that is what made DJing what it is.
Is that like the Fender, you know, Stratocaster of turntables?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is the one. When you picture the turntable in your head without even trying, you are looking at the 1200.
And when you decided to get into this business, when you were probably just a kid, you thought, I got to get my hands on one of those things.
Yeah. I mean, eventually, like, my dad actually had a Technics 1500. My dad is a little bit of a, and he had a Technics tape deck. He's a bit of an audiophile, you know, not too serious about it, but he actually DJed a bit too. Like, he would play parties with 45s and stuff, but it was just for fun. But because he was a music fan. So he had a Technics 1500, which is not the it's not the 1200. There's certain features of the 1200 that make it so solid,
right.
But it was a really good starting point for me. Once he let me use it and all that.
and so they, created that. And so they were asking you to be down in Las Vegas and
so
show off their latest goods.
So they stopped making them in, I want to say like 2006 or something like that, much to the chagrin of the whole DJ industry.
Well, that also makes them cool too, because it becomes vintage gear.
Yeah. And well, the thing about them is they are, to me, it might be the most efficient piece of electronics I've ever touched. Like, they just don't die.
Right.
You might have to replace the RCA cable, or you might have to replace the tone arm or something, but these things are just workhorses. And it's kind of one of those things, like, how does a machine like that survive in this current, you know, product world of temporary and planned obsolescence?
And so many people don't even bother with the classic vinyl turntable.
Yeah, but you know. I think that is changing, and you hear lots of things about vinyl coming back and everything. And I do think I think it's around, but even in the DJ world, like in the early mid 2000s, you had people moving a bit more towards digital because, hey, oh, we can have all the music in the world on this one hard drive or USB stick or whatever.
I remember the actual hardware started to look quite different. It was these smaller, disky kind of looking things.
Yeah. I think that, like, now that we've had that stuff for like, you know, 10 years or whatever, kind of like, hey, I kind of like picking what I want to take to the gig, and I kind of like only having a certain amount of records, the ones I really care about, and everything.
Brian Eno once said in a speech I saw him give, and I've said this a few times, but options are the enemy. And he really believed that about the digital, the new morning of digital that was arriving, you know, 20-25 years ago.
Sure, and I think we can all feel that way about some part of digital in some part of our life, whether it's hanging on to pictures or music, or, you know, you've got hard drives here and there, you kind of know where things are, but you're like, it's a little overwhelming sometimes. Like, so that being said, there are some amazing features of digital DJing that have totally changed the way I DJ and have allowed me to do incredible projects.
You just put it into your toolbox.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, there's certain stuff that, like pitch lock and things like that, where I can now change the speed something's playing at, but preserve the pitch.
Right. That's unbelievable.
I can transpose it as well, like with the click of a button. So that's allowed me to take it to musical levels that wasn't previously available.
So you were in Vegas with the latest from Technics.
Sure, so they brought one back. Brought a Technics 1200 back.
So this is new. Have they done something different to it?
Or? Not too much. Right. I think they a couple small features and like cosmetic things, but really it was a chance for me to go back and say, okay, it's here. So my approach for the showcases, I was playing the 3 or 4 minute set every 30 minutes for 4 days.
You're a workhorse. This is what I'm talking about.
It was just like, it was like free practice for me, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, but it was fun. I really wanted to use the new
free
not for them, for me, I guess.
I find that very hard to believe.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't free. But let's just call it practice.
Sure.
And
it was good practice.
Yeah, it was fun. I wanted to give the things a good shake, you know. They're back, let me just get comfortable with them, because with any kind of instrument or something, you can look at it, you can feel it, you can play it a bit, but it's really that long-term feel that makes it what it is. And so I wanted to see, you know, if they upheld their legacy, and I do believe they did. So I'm excited to get a pair when they come out.
The first time I think I really locked into who you were, you've been around, like a lot of us, you've been around for a while, but sometimes it takes this, you know, touchstone for people to kind of lock in. And I just remember seeing the Let's Dance David Bowie YouTube video and going, holy smokes, what do we have here? And we just walked down to your studio and saw your records and your tables and everything, which was magic for me. But can you place, was that a moment where things kind of took off in a certain way, or was that just part of the tapestry?
Yeah.
How did that work?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, that was when I think back of just certain days in, at least in the modern sort of like social media world, that was like a special day where it just, that just disrupted my whole day in the best way possible.
I mean, it's got like hundreds of thousands of views at this point, I think.
Yeah, well, on Facebook, it got 12 million views.
12 million?
Yeah. On YouTube, it's significant. It was Facebook. It was like right had a really good time for Facebook videos.
Yeah,
good time for Facebook.
Zuckerberg isn't doing it all wrong.
Yeah, at least in your book. He was cranking up the heat the
video
on the
content.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and think about how video content changed at that moment.
Exactly.
Every CEO worth their salt was talking about video content.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So. And so I've learned over the years that just as DJing, the video content is one of the best ways. I even don't really like the word content, but videos of
Nor do I.
Yeah.
Just having a conversation about that this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just video is just a great way of capturing what I do because it is visually stimulating as well as audio, and the matching of the video and audio when people kind of are making that connection between what I'm doing with my hands and what's coming out of the speaker. I feel like that's, you know, my best format. The thing about scratching is when I first started scratching, a lot of the times there wasn't a video to match the audio. So you'd hear these sounds. You'd be like, how do they come out like that? But now we have the ability to share videos of it. And I think it's always been a visually impressive thing. But to take us to when that video came out, I had been working late on a mixtape, actually. I do like a year-end mixtape called Songs We Listen To A Lot In whatever year it was.
Yeah, 2013, yeah. 2012. Whatever.
And I was working on, I believe that would have been 16 or 15. I forget. When did Bowie pass in 16? It was January.
It was 16.
I think January 16th.
Yeah.
So I was working late on that, like oh man, I got to get this mixtape finished. And I was working. And it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. And at that time, I checked Facebook and I saw people started like sort of commemorating Bowie. Like people said, oh, rest in peace, Dave Bowie. Oh, like the news broke in England in the morning.
What a day.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I think almost any music fan can remember that. That's like a very, very huge milestone in, because he just touched so many people.
Just from an art standpoint.
Yeah, exactly. Not even music. Yeah,
I think just people just really could see that he had changed culture. He had pushed so many boundaries.
I mean, everyone had
then musically too. So
yeah, and everyone had a story about how their life was connected to Bowie in one way or another.
Right.
Whether it was music or Labyrinth or whatever it was.
Or even the final record was such a send-off.
Yeah. You know, so. I mean, and his music just crossed so many genres and styles. And it was so late here, and you know, no one's up in North America at 4 a.m. You're not talking to anybody. That's kind of why I get my stuff done at that hour.
Right.
And these messages started coming in, and I said, oh man, like I felt like saying something, because like you want to say what this moment means to you. And I think, I don't know if I was tired or whatever, I was like, oh man, I don't really feel like, I probably typed 2 or 3 things and deleted them and just said, okay, I don't feel like doing this right now. And so I just felt like going to play with his records, like, because I've been doing a routine with Let's Dance for, I don't know, since the early 2000s. I got 2 copies of the 12-inch, and I've been messing with them forever. So I got them. Like, they're already marked up. They're ready to go. So I pulled them out, and I was playing around with it, and I was having fun with it. And I said, okay, well, let me just, like, videotape this really quickly.
Yeah.
So I just set up a videotape, probably did 3 or 4 takes, got a good one. Said, okay, cool. And then I put it in and said, oh, this is cool. And I rendered it, blah, blah, blah. And then I posted it. So this was probably about 5:30, 6 in the morning. Okay, let me post this before I go to bed. And then I went up and I brushed my teeth, and then I came back down, and I just clicked refresh, and it was like in 10 minutes it had 100,000 views already. And I was like, what is going on with this?
That,
like,
is unbelievable.
And it was like,
that is social media dream.
Yeah,
comes,
it was
dreams
crazy.
Come true.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh my gosh.
And so I was like, oh man. And it was like, all right, let me just hang around for another 10 minutes and like click refresh and just see what happened. And it was kind of crazy. I didn't know what to do. I was just very excited that it was connecting with so many people, and it was like, it was crazy to watch. Just I got personal messages from people saying that was like, that was what helped them get over the sadness of missing Bowie, or that brought them back to a certain time with that record, or it was a welcome change to some of the, you know, the sadness or whatever that people were seeing. And it just made me really happy that it connected like that.
two things I learned from that video rewatching it just recently was God bless Nile Rodgers for just
what a genius yeah, absolute genius, one
and,
of my favorites.
And then who plays guitar, by the way, rhythm guitar on that track, Stevie Ray Vaughan on the solo.
Mm-hmm. And then Nile produced it too. He produced the record.
And I'll also point out that I took am I using the terminology correct, but the little deal that goes between the two record players, that's just a fader, is
crossfader.
Crossfader, yeah. Right, so I'm just making sure I got my terminology right. you're being pretty liberal, and I wouldn't say aggressive, but you're using that to your full advantage. Yeah. There, and I'm thinking, do those things break pretty regularly?
They are pretty durable.
They
now.
Are
I mean
okay.
By the time the late 90s came around and the tech companies realized that DJs were working these things to the core,
right,
they started developing stronger, more solid faders,
titanium-based crossfaders.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, that is the thing. That is you are working that thing. And just for people that are out there listening, it's the fader that goes between the left and the right turntable, so it moves horizontally. And when it's all the way on one side, you hear the right one, and then when it's all the way on the other side, you hear the left one. And when you what you kind of do is you have it pushed with your thumb against one side, and you're kind of tapping it on with your fingers so that it kind of leaks in and bleeds in, and that's the rhythm that you're doing. So for instance, in the Let's Dance routine, I take the starting chant,
the Beatles rip off.
Yeah, exactly. And just I go like, you know, you transform those things, and then it makes its own little rhythm with that.
It was a little piece of genius. The next time that I you know, obviously have kept in touch with your music, but the next time I saw you was with DJ Jazzy Jeff at Kerner Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a couple, I guess it was 2017.
Yeah, it was a year ago. It was a year ago.
And Shad, and you had this sort of heavy rock act with you that night as well.
Yeah, Reverse. The band. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of, I don't know if I would classify them as heavy rock, but they play pretty heavy. Like
did that night anyway.
Yeah, the drummer Chino is a heavy drummer, cat. So it's a drummer Chino, the bassist Damien, the guitar player Rob, and I'm just a fan of that band. I saw them around town playing and said we should collaborate, because they do a lot of inspired covers and original material that
they're great.
Yeah, and then I said I could maybe add something to this mix, and Reverse.
So I assume you have some kind of relationship going with Jazzy Jeff over the years.
Yeah, me and Jeff, I first met Jeff in Halifax. I opened for him.
Wow.
Back in the vinyl days, strictly vinyl days.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been like, I want to say like 03 or 04.
Yeah.
And he came to the city, and of course, Jeff is he's the DJ's DJ, and I don't think you'll meet a DJ on the planet that doesn't look up to that guy.
Right.
And I was very honored to have the opening slot for him. And I had this opening slot with another DJ, a local DJ in Halifax, and we worked it together. And he did this thing, the other DJ did this thing to me, and I don't think it was technically on purpose, but back when you brought records, you could only bring certain ones. And he started playing, and he really took the crowd in one direction, which is a bit more of sort of a commercial hip-hop R&B vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And me opening for Jazzy Jeff, I kind of brought what I felt was like the truest hip hop, and he had the crowd really going with this like commercial R&B, and I was like, oh man, I have nothing that will, if I start to play after this, it's gonna like, people are gonna be like,
the bridge is gonna be weird.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was actually pretty, you know, a peppy little redheaded 22-year-old or something. I was pretty ticked off by this, and anyway, whatever. I was like, oh man, this is my chance to open for Jazzy Jeff, and I'm gonna lose the crowd and blah blah blah, blah. And I said to him, man, I got nothing like this. I was like, just give me the last 10 minutes of the set and I'll be fine,
right?
And so he gave me the last 10 minutes of the set, and I like planned out like the best little mega mix of 10 minutes of madness that I could, and I did it. And I remember like that, like the response from the crowd was just explosive. And then I didn't get a chance to meet Jeff that night, but
wow.
Like, I actually had two shows. I just remembered it was crazy, and I went out in the crowd to enjoy Jeff, and I was like feeling great about everything, coming from feeling bad. And then we played Moncton the next night. It was like a two show tour.
Yeah.
And I went to soundcheck.
Minimalist tour.
Yeah, exactly. And I went to soundcheck, and I brought my Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince Rock the House album, and I was like, I gotta get this signed by Jeff. And so I brought the record, and he was soundtracking. I brought brought it over to him when he was done. And I said, "Hey, Jeff, great show last night. It's a real pleasure to meet you." And I gave him the record, and he took it and he signed, and he gave it back to me, and it said, "To my man, Scratch Bastard, keep rocking, DJ Jazzy Jeff." And I never told him my name.
Oh, wow.
Until I gave him the record. But then I got it back. I was like, oh man, he knows my name.
Somebody took notice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then that night we connected, we played the show. It was really fun. And just over the years, we played a bunch of shows after that, and we always stayed in touch. And then one day I gave him a mix CD at this Halloween show we did. 3 months later, maybe, he just randomly out of nowhere tweeted, "Rolling to Vegas, bumping my man, Scratch Bastard, mix CD." And I looked at my phone and I got that. I took a picture of it. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, you give people CDs for fun and you don't expect them to do that, you know? So, and I hit him back, said thank you. He's like, "Man, I love this CD." He's like, "We got to connect and we got to trade some music and blah, blah, blah." So we just kept going like that.
It's a good moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
Yeah.
And now this thing that I do now is the Red Bull Freestyle World DJ Championships.
Right.
I was just in Taipei doing the 9th installment of those. And Jeff has actually been a part of that for 9 years. So every year, and I've been a part of it every year. So every year we kind of have that DJ camp thing that we hang out. And we just become, he's one of my best friends now. And I can say that he's one of the nicest people in the world and super happy to have that.
And he seems like a real guy who, I mean, just from what I saw of him, I mean, I grew up listening to his music, obviously, with the Fresh Prince and everything. But when I saw him with you at Kerner Hall, it wasn't your classic turntable, you know, gymnastics routine.
Yeah.
It was a bit more laid back.
His producer side.
A little more. But he just seems like he really cares about music and supporting young artists. And that's his deal.
He's super passionate about music. And so everyone that you saw on stage with him was people that he believes in, people that he wants to help shine the light on, et cetera, et cetera. And including Glenn Lewis from Toronto, who actually lived in Philly during the neo-soul movement.
Big talent.
Yeah, huge talent. Yeah. So I think Jeff supports who he believes in and is a loyal friend to all who are friends of his, and I'm very happy that I'm one of them.
Explain what's happening here, because this is on your SoundCloud right now. It's a track that was recently released, of course, probably elsewhere too. But anyway, quote, Jay-Z-Lucifer, bracket Yuki times Ticklish times Scratch Bastard remix.
Yes.
Unbracket.
Yes.
So what am I looking at there?
That is what we'd call a classic collab bootleg,
right?
Facilitated by the internet.
Uh-huh.
So Yuki is from Japan.
Break it down for me.
Sure. Yuki's from Japan.
Okay.
Ticklish is from Germany.
All right.
And I'm from Canada.
Uh-huh.
So Yuki he actually lives in New York now. I play a bunch of his records and his remixes, and we become really good friends that way, because he'll see sets of mine and I'll say, he'll send me stuff and be like, "I think this is up your alley."
Uh-huh.
I'm like, "Perfect. I play it in my sets." And then he's like, "Oh, this is great. We should collaborate on something." So also, this guy Ticklish, I play some of his stuff.
Right.
And Yuki and Ticklish decide now, if you have a musical idea, you can make it in Ableton Live or Logic, upload it, and pass it off to someone else. Hey, check this out. What do you want to do on it?
Yeah.
And then, so I think the sequence was Yuki passed it off to Ticklish, and then Ticklish passed it back to Yuki, and then Yuki passed it to me to add some scratches to it, basically.
And we'll start out by saying that it is Jay-Z. It's a Jay-Z track.
Yeah, it's a bootleg. The a cappella is partially Jay-Z.
Yeah.
There's also Max Romeo, Chase the Devil sample in there. There's also a sample from Sister Nancy, Bam Bam. And there's another sample from the Showboys, Drag Rap, which is kind of a New Orleans regional hip-hop sample, basically.
It looks like musical algebra to me. You know, it's an equation of some sort.
I mean, I don't know. Like, if we were all in the same room, the title would have probably came out the same way. But this is what 2018 looks like. It's just like collaborative creation.
Jumping all over the planet.
Yeah. And that's just a little fun thing that we posted for DJs mostly to play in their sets. And it's totally, we can't sell it or anything like that. I would call it illegal, except it's just a cool creative thing that other DJs can play and supporting good music.
Musicians somebody, even if I was huge, I'd like to think that if I heard that and I saw these three incredible DJs from around the planet having some fun with it, collaborating on it, mm-hmm. how could you be mad at
yeah,
that?
I know. Well, it just...
Have you run into that?
Honestly, no. At the creative. It's just the sell. It's the money part, right?
It's always the money.
It's always the money part.
BB King said, get that money.
Right. You know, and it's sort of like, it's cut and paste culture. It's collage stuff. That's what it is. And as a DJ, you always run into some problems with clearance and this sort of thing. You got to be a little careful about what you want to sell in the music industry. But ultimately, the creative aspect of it is this reinterpretation. It's, for instance, the Bowie routine. Like, yeah. I don't know. I didn't get clearance from Bowie or anybody to do that, but it resonated with so many people and they got it. And, you know, it's a homage.
Once you have that goodwill, it's
yeah, I didn't
pretty
sell
hard
it,
to
you know?
Argue with it.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. But then, you know, last week I tried to post a set of mine from Taiwan to the internet and everything was okay except the one Prince song that I put in there, and they said it was on. They had to cancel it, so I had to snip the Prince song out and put it back together.
Isn't that
and,
something?
That's
a powerful estate.
It is. Yeah. And you can never be mad at Prince.
Well, no, and he probably would have done that to you.
He staunchly defends his catalog, yeah. and that's fair to me. But I know for a fact that Prince has had DJs on his performances and records and samples and everything like that. So.
Seems like Bat Dance was full of samples.
For sure.
He must not
understand
how that works.
But you said, yeah, I don't know. But you know, Prince has had his trials and tribulations with the music industry.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, he decided to set up a fortress around everything.
Another massive loss.
Yeah, huge loss. Yeah,
ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. We mentioned Bedford, Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. You're coming up, I guess, in what, late 80s kind of thing?
Yeah, I was born in 82. So I got into music obsessively through Much Music in the early 90s, I would say.
It's good to hear. I sometimes felt that I'm a little older than you. I think I'm 43 or 36, mm-hmm. is that right? So mm-hmm. yeah, so I mean, I sometimes felt like that died with my little Gen X group, but it seems to me a lot of people who got into the 90s, mid 90s, it was still very much part of their lives.
Very much.
I always stand up for it because I think it was, at that time, there were so many different genres of music on
yeah.
Much Music
oh, yeah.
that it really exposed you to a lot.
Absolutely.
Everything from hip-hop to country to folk, you know, it was all
to
there.
To metal,
yeah,
to
metal.
The Wedge, whatever
yeah.
was on the Wedge,
Alt.
Alternative, yeah. you know. Yeah, I mean, like, I was there for Nirvana and, yeah. like, watching it every day and seeing that whole thing unfold.
Now, I was sort of age when that was happening.
Right. Yeah, you were
I was like, you know,
in the clubs.
Yeah, kind of 15, 16, 17
yeah.
in there. You were younger.
Yeah, like 10, 11, 12. But I was watching, you know, and my mom would be like, you can't watch this stuff or whatever. When she saw the heart-shaped box video, she's like, I don't like this.
When I talked to Tom Power, he seems to, the host of CBCQ.
Yep.
I mean, he talks
another East Coaster.
Yeah, another
yeah.
East Coaster. He talks about that too because he really, it would affected him. And it always shocks me because I think, well, you were like 9.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But
obviously it was.
And out there, you just don't have a whole lot, man.
Right.
The Much Music was our portal into Toronto, into the rest of the country, into the rest of the world, really. You
right.
know, we'd see Speaker's Corner, like, all I want to do is go down to Speaker's Corner and say something.
Well, I'm from Victoria, so of
okay,
course
so
it was exact,
the, yeah,
same
exactly.
idea for
so,
me.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this place
yeah.
called Hamilton? You
yeah.
know, I hear about
yeah.
you know, Windsor.
Yeah, but it was, I mean, much respect to Much Music because that was just a huge eye-opener for me. And I watched the Countdown every week and I'd watch all the programs. Like we said, The Wedge, Power Hour,
right.
Extend-A-Mix with Master T, and then Rap City.
I've kept up with most of the DJs, and I've worked with many of them, mm-hmm. DJs, I guess mm-hmm. I should say, Erica M, and I
yeah.
worked with Dan Gallagher
uh-huh,
and all these
uh-huh,
great people.
Uh-huh.
But I never know what really happened to Master T.
Yeah, Master T, I see him around every
people tell
now
me
and
this.
Then.
Yeah.
yeah, I'm not entirely sure what he's up to.
Yeah.
As a general thing, but you know he was well revered in the community.
It
for
gave
sure.
you a well rounded look at our music scene.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We could use an injection in that right now.
I think.
Sure. Oh, kids these days.
Master T was awesome, man,
yeah.
for sure. But yeah, I used to see stuff. The Countdown was where you'd watch like the chart, and then yeah. you'd see these songs from different genres breaking into that. And then I got into hip hop through that. Like I saw Naughty by Nature, Hip Hop Hooray,
right.
and I saw.
Hey,
yeah, ho. They play. And I said, this is great.
Yeah.
And then also I bought Much Music Dance Mix 93-94, and House of Pain was on there.
I think my stepson had those records.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
So like
very popular.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they were big, but they're good. If you go back, there's some huge songs on there.
Some magic mixes.
There's some magic mixes for sure. And I guess that was where I learned a lot. And then I got a bit deeper with it. And then I do have to say the next step would have probably been college radio,
right?
Because college, that's something that it still exists, but not in the capacity it existed back then, because like outside of TV and whatever was on cable,
yeah,
the next thing was college radio.
Well, it was a level deeper.
Yes, that, and you didn't have anything else.
Yeah,
right. This is before the internet.
Right.
So you
imagine that.
Imagine this, guys. Yeah. and from there, that was how I connected or linked with pretty much my main first inspiration, which was Buck 65.
Right.
And he's from Nova Scotia as well. And
so let me talk about that. Two quick things that you've reminded me of. One is that I do feel that way of taking in music and experiencing music, what you're talking about, college radio and so on, it's starting to feel very distant.
It is,
It's feeling like the way that we learned it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we should hang on to that feeling or champion it in any way, but
the world has changed so much, you know? And I still enjoy college radio in the car. Sometimes tuning in online in the background or something like that. But we're just so bombarded with multimedia now. And I mean, back then, we didn't have all these videos on our phone or screen. We didn't have computers.
Right.
You know? Like,
harder to cut through and all the rest.
So, when I think of college radio, I think of being in my bedroom doing my homework and listening to CKDU, positioning the radio in a certain position where it got the best signal.
Yeah.
And just doing my homework and
hitting record on
Tuesday night at 9. Yeah, of course.
Maybe on the cassette deck.
Yeah, of course. I got tapes downstairs that we could go listen to if you want.
Still going.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you my history with Buck 65 because you mentioned him. I got a job in 2010. They asked for a producer to come in and help out and bring in maybe a little private radio knowledge to CBC Radio to drive with Rich Terfrey. And I said, I would like to do that job. And I used to listen to Jürgen Gotth back in the old Radio 2 days. And I always thought, gosh, I would love to work on that show. Now, obviously, it had changed quite dramatically since Rich had taken over. But so Rich and I were together for 5 years, just the two of us in a studio every day.
Wow.
So I thought you might get a kick out
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, me and Terfrey.
For those who have, Rich is Buck 65.
Rich is Buck 65. That's
and Rich.
That must have been a huge thing for you to see him kind of take off.
Absolutely.
As an artist.
I mean, I saw that happen in a lot of ways. I kind of jumped on the Buck 65 bandwagon, if you can call it that. I don't know. I wouldn't call it the bandwagon. I just became a fan of his through his radio show, which was him being a fan of hip hop. But then he would start to play a couple of his own tunes, just casually, I think maybe just to get them out there, not really pushing them too hard, not forcing them on people.
That's very typical.
Yeah. He would just put them on. And at first I was like, I don't really like this song. I was like, this is pretty cool. And he had a character, and I bought the tapes. And, you know, I would go down to Sandman.
Is that the Stinkin' Rich
days? Yeah, Stinkin' Rich phase. He put out I think my first one would be an album called Weirdo Magnet, double cassette with scotch tape in the middle of two cassettes, and photocopy, Hannah Christensen photocopy of face on the cover, Weirdo Magnet. And it was just, I remember listening to it, and it's just like, what is this stuff? It's cool. The beats were interesting. He was saying cool stuff that I could kind of relate to, telling stories of East Coast growing up a little bit, but not like I'm from, just sort of like, it was cool.
He seemed to be a guy that, from what I could gather, that really was into, you know, he could name any beat. Like, you'd play him a bit of a drum machine.
Yeah.
A bit of a beat
he was
from a
deep,
hip-hop
man.
Record. And he could cite
obsessive.
Where everything came
from. Yeah. And that made me want to be obsessive, too, because he could do that. And I'm like, okay. You want to, when you find someone like that, it's like you want to stump them or something. So I was like, let me go dig through all my parents' records to see if I can find drums that Buck doesn't know about.
Of course. And I was so, deer in the headlights on the subject that I would, he'd be talking about these things and kind of look at me and I'd say, well, beats me. I don't know. I mean, but I was very impressed with that.
Yeah.
That deep knowledge. And I guess, would we say there was a Beastie Boys influence there, or would that be unfair?
I think so. But I think, like, sometimes there's this, thing about the Beastie Boys and their position in hip hop being sort of the white group in hip hop,
right,
that when you're a white dude making hip hop music, you don't like being compared to the Beastie Boys because people kind of paint like somehow. So, but definitely, I mean, I know that Rich likes the Beastie Boys for sure. But it's just that once you get compared to them, it's sort of like, that's too easy of a comparison, and maybe comparing for the wrong reasons to Strictly Color or something like that.
Of course.
Yeah.
How about you?
Absolutely.
I've just been thinking about them lately because I just read the book.
I got the book up on my bedside table right now.
I mean, I went.
It's great.
I blasted through it pretty quick. And I have to say, I mean, it just reignited that fire.
Yeah. I'm like 20 pages in.
Okay.
And,
well, when you're going to bed at 5:30 a.m., what are you going to do?
Yeah, but like, I mean, Buck's style was very like the Beastie Boys, the break beats, the drums, his approach. I mean, the Beasties were inspired by New York hip hop, and so was Rich, and then me too. I mean, the Beastie Boys record that I remember came out when I was into hip hop was Ill Communication,
right?
And so Sure Shot and Root Down, and I mean, I love
arguably the towering champion of all their records. Maybe, certainly, I mean, the highest Paul's selling. Routique, I would think.
Yeah, it was a great point for them.
Maybe
yeah.
Fight for Your Right had sold more records.
Yeah, well, License to Ill. I think License to Ill. But then, in a way, they moved away from License to Ill, and I'm sure that gets that in that book. They became something that they didn't expect to become, and all of a sudden, frat boys were like, "You gotta fight," you know? Like,
yeah, I tell people all the time. It reminds me a lot of the story of the Beatles because it really starts in this one place and it moves in a spiritual and creative and completely different direction.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing tale. And it's
absolutely. Buck, I think, is inspired by them, but there was this extra East Coast touch. And because I listened to the radio show, and because I would go see him at his job at Paper Chase and buy cassettes straight from him at the magazine store and stuff, like,
how was that?
Amazing. I would go when I was a kid, I would take the bus in from Bedford to Halifax, and I would go to Sam the Record Man, I would go to HMV, I would go to Urban Sound Exchange, which was the used store, and I would stop into Paper Chase to see if Rich was there and wait to him. And Rich would be working behind the counter selling magazines and cigarettes, and he'd sell tapes, and we'd just talk and stuff. Like, you know, I mean, I'm very, very thankful for having Rich as a early influence in my life, for sure. He showed me that you could be yourself, unique, and from the East Coast, and do your thing and have impact all over.
And a huge model. I mean, you guys are different. I mean, what you guys do professionally is different.
For sure.
But it's like you say, it's a bit of a roadmap there to how this might go.
Yeah, and I think like we worked together on an album called Situation that I produced in full. And
Juno nominated, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, producer of the year. I got nominated. I lost to Joni Mitchell.
It's a good record.
Yeah.
Symphonic record,
And Rich and I, we kind of drifted apart a little bit after that record, but I think it was mostly just like different stuff we had going on in our lives. And I saw him recently at the Jazzy J exhibit, where Jazzy J is from Def Jam.
Right.
Beastie Boys connection, I guess.
Totally.
He was around for those
in the books,
early days. So he actually had a little exhibit down on Dundas of like all this memorabilia, and Rich was there, and I could just seeing him there looking at the stuff, I was like, yeah, I can see that kind of classic Rich like fandom, hip hop fandom.
So for me, when I went through a massive hip hop stage in sort of the late 80s, that was, you know, I'm thinking about
Public Enemy,
Fat Boys. Fat Boys don't get the cred, eh?
Oh man, they made some great records.
They did.
And Curtis Blow was producing those records.
Fresh Prince, Jazzy Jeff, Beasties, Public Enemy, Big Daddy Kane, Professor Griff, Third Base, NWA, Digital Underground. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were all just
rap tracks.
Just happening all the time. Then into De La Soul and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in my mind, that's sort of this weird second, not weird, but it's a second wave of hip hop compared to what we think about as the late 70s, early 80s originals. So when does that music become important for you? Because I was sort of a weird perfect age, you know, 12, 13, and it was really sinking in. You know, you're really young at that point.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I early 90s. So I never bought
Must be a slightly different group of hip hop artists.
Yes. So I got into hip hop a little bit through videos and much music, but then I remember seeing there was a big crossover tune by Method Man and Mary J. Blige called You're All I Need to Get By. So it's like reinterpreted the Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell classic. And I just loved the combination. Like, and the rap was great, the beat was great, and the singing was, it really hooked me. And then later on Rap City, I saw his video for Bring the Pain, where he's riding around on a bus with like it just, like, the energy was so raw. And I go, my friend had the CD, and I'm like, what's that? Let me hear that Method Man CD. And it was one of the, like, just so dark and, like, dingy and, like, just kind of scary, or like, just, it was just, what is this music? And I was just like, instantly became hooked on this sound. And he's like, well, he's from this group called the Wu-Tang Clan. And I was like, oh, cool, the Wu-Tang Clan, cool. So we liked Method Man, and we saw that there was different features on that, and then we found the Wu-Tang Clan album, and then that changed my life. It really did.
Yeah.
Like, this was this group of 9 people that, like, all had, there were songs had different combinations of people, and the beats were all over the place, and I mean,
a lot of different personalities.
Yeah, but the whole album had no 2 songs were the same, but everyone was exciting and different, and the stories were great, and I just became obsessed with
that. And I like that they sort of had like a doctrine and like a iconography, and like, oh, there was a whole, system totally. That went around it.
That appealed to my young mind, because I was into like sports, and I collected baseball cards, sure, and things like that. So this whole idea of like kind of collecting the characters of the Wu-Tang Clan was a thing. I remember I used to write in my school books, like I'd make lists, and like I would talk about their features or their alias. They all had like 4 aliases, and you had to listen close to figure out what they were. And right. It was like, it was exciting to be a fan of it at that point. And you're waiting for the next record to come out. What's it going to be like? Who's going to be on it? Who's going to be featured on it? And it was like, it was a great thing for me at that time to be upset. Like,
I feel like Juggalo culture kind of took that to the next level in a weird sort of way, almost like wrestling in a way.
Yeah. I would hesitate for myself to connect those two just for my own pride. Yeah, right,
that's fair. But at the same time, it is sort of helpful. I mean, even Public Enemy, you could argue, created characters within their group.
With Professor Griff, S1Ws, Flavor Flav, obviously. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
That was big for you. Did you happen to see them when they came to town, and everybody thought that most of them would be missing?
No. Yeah, they came to town for like a weed gig.
Right. And then they actually all showed up.
Yeah, I didn't see that show. I saw them in Minneapolis earlier in the summer, the whole crew.
Okay.
And it was great. And I've seen different combinations. I actually DJed for Raekwon and Ghostface at Dundas Square.
Holy smokes.
For, I believe it was...
God Bless the City Planning.
North by Northeast.
Right, okay.
It was a free show. Yeah. That I got a call that day saying they need a DJ. I was at the Blue Jays game.
What happens in your heart in that moment?
You know what? My first instinct was to say no.
Of course.
I said no, because there's this thing that live performers, rap people that aren't organized can do, where they hire a DJ that don't give, and then they kind of shame him almost, they blame him, like the sound man, it's like the sound man.
Any different for when guys like Wilson Pickett or what have you, mm-hmm, back in the day, mm-hmm, it's like, I'll show up with my guitar and the band better be good, or else I'm going to be giving them hell. And it's like, well, wait a sec.
Exactly. Yeah. So I said no at first, and then I hung up the phone, and I was at the Jays game with a couple of friends, and I was like, huh, that was funny. And they're like, what? And I was like, I just got asked to DJ for Raekwon and Ghostface. They're like, oh my god. And they looked at me, and I paused, and they were like, what did you say? And I was like, no. And they're like, are you crazy? And I was like, oh man. Like, and I had another gig that night, and I was like, oh, okay. Like, okay. And then I called them back and said, okay, I think I can make this happen. Let's figure it out. And it ended up being like,
you leave the Jays game?
No, I mean, it all worked out perfectly. Like, I got to watch the Jays game, relax, texted a few people, got some emails, got the instrumentals to the show in my inbox.
Get a little hype going too, let a few people know.
And sure. I was really excited to do it. When I think back, I'm really happy that I took it.
How did they go? They treat you okay?
They treated me amazing, actually. Oh, wow. Like, I got there, the manager was like, you got the instrumentals? I was like, yep. He's like, all right, cool. He's like, go sit over there. And so I was backstage, and I sit down on the couch, and I'm sitting here. Then like, in walks Raekwon, and Raekwon sits on my left side. And then, and then in walks Ghostface, and Ghostface sits on my right side. I've got my laptop in front of me with, like, a zip of instrumentals. Yeah. And and a tech, like a text file with like a couple different sets, and we open it up and we just were talking about what, how we're going to put the show together. And there was a moment there where I looked to my left and my right, and I was like, holy smokes, if that little kid from Nova Scotia could imagine that I'd be sitting in that position right then.
It's outrageous.
Yeah. And even just the inner dialogue between the two of them, hearing them go back and forth, was just, it was just amazing for me as a fan to hear them talk about what they want to do and why they want to do it. And there was certain songs that Ghostface wanted to do that Raekwon didn't, and vice versa. I had to hear them kind of like talk about why they wanted to do it, and I had a little bit of input too. And
wow,
as a DJ for the show, I would kind of push the show in a couple of directions. You know, I think some shows they're just sort of expected to turn around and say push play,
right?
And I would sort of just like read the energy as a DJ and like sometimes put some songs on a little early, or like, or like create some flow to the set that I felt would add to it as a fan, and just like as knowing the songs, and I pushed them a little bit, but I think it created really good results.
That's so great.
Yeah,
that is so great. What a great story. That is amazing. So Wu-Tang is big, and then what's the moment where you're like, oh, you know what, I'm gonna get some tables and I'm gonna lock myself in a room and figure this
right
out.
Well, yeah. Digging deeper again, getting into Wu-Tang Clan and hip-hop, I you know, this is stuff you could buy at Sam the Record Man and whatnot, and then listening to Buck's show, I started to hear all these like these B-sides and these remixes, and he had the instrumentals of songs. And I was like, where is he getting these?
Finding the stems, as he would say.
Yeah, but I mean, back then it was on the 12 inches.
Right.
The singles, I mean, in Canada, we didn't really have much of a cassette or CD single like they did in the States. It's like, he had the vinyl. So I was like, oh man, I got to find the vinyl. This was like probably in 96, 97. You'd see a couple like mail order things in Source magazine.
Now, you had already had the baseball card thing going, so you knew a little bit about obsession.
Yeah, of course.
It wasn't too far away.
I'm like,
from
yeah,
you.
I need these records. So like
I was a comic book guy, right, and stuff. Right. So I know a little bit what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And when you're that age, it's really fun.
Well, you don't have much else to do, and it becomes the thing that you want to do and keeps you out of trouble and everything like that.
Yeah.
So my friend, who's the guy that gave me the Method Man CD, or we used to hang out every weekend, and we would buy cassettes and CDs and make mixtapes, the best 3-4 songs from each of the albums that we bought that week or that month or whatever. And then we started saying, okay, we got to get this vinyl. So his dad used to take trips to Toronto, and as did mine. And they would sometimes get CDs and cassettes that we couldn't get in Nova Scotia, you know, they did certain ones didn't make it out there.
Sure.
They would find these albums that were out there. And then one trip, his dad started bringing back some vinyl from Play-Doh Record. And so he brought back like 40. He's like, I need this, this, and this, if you can do it. And he brought them back. And we were like, oh my God, you know, we had all these songs you couldn't get on CD or cassette. And then we were like, oh, I became obsessed with it. Around this time, the internet started popping off. we found these online ordering things. We're like, okay, cool. We started making orders for vinyl, and we started amassing this collection. We went down to New York that summer. We bought some records at Fat Beats, came back, and we had like about a crate of records. And then we're like, okay, we start playing with the records. You know, you put them on the turntable, and then you're like, well, what happens if I go wicker, wicker? You know,
like, of course.
And then it sounds awful at first, and then you're like, okay, well, I need to learn more about this. So from that mail order online mail order site, we saw these VHS tapes of DJs in battles, and one called Turntable Mechanic Workshop by the Invisible Scratch Pickles, which was the group that Mixmaster Mike was in, even though he wasn't in that video. And it was like a DJ teaching the VHS.
That must have been invaluable.
It was. It was also, come to find out, recorded in their garage while they were high on acid. And it's just these guys doing...
You should make an instructional video, you know.
It's just these guys doing scratches and showing you, and like, and I would watch it and like, how do they, and he's talking like a cowboy and half, it's just super.
It reminds me of like snowboard videos or surf videos.
Exactly.
Or just really
skate
goofy
videos.
And
exactly.
Crazy and...
Exactly. But that was sort of the counterculture stuff. It was like, why does this company want me to make a video on how to do this? It's like, if you know, you know. Like, let's just have fun with it. And I would watch it, and you know, but beyond the silliness and everything, lied this raw skills. So I'd watch it and be like, oh man, like, look at that. And I would go downstairs and try to do it, you know, and just by sort of like watching, listening and trial and error. And then it just spawned from there.
When did you realize that, you know, there's always that moment of, okay, I'm going to try something. I mean, I tried painting, for example. I'm no painter. I tried piano. I'm okay.
Yeah.
But there must have been that moment where you were feeling like, okay, I think this is actually starting to happen.
Well, so I was, at this time, I was spending a lot of time in the basement practicing, and my mother was like, you know,
What was the situation? Mom and dad both around? And
yeah.
You had
yeah.
siblings? Or?
Yeah, I have three younger siblings.
Oldest,
oldest of four.
Me too.
There you go.
How about that? Kind of
fight it on. I knew this interview was meant to be.
You got to kind of fight it on your own, eh?
Yeah, and you got to break that ice, you know? I broke a lot of ice.
Sure.
My mom is, she's from Trinidad. She's a bit of a, you know, tough Caribbean mom.
Sure.
She doesn't like cursing, and that was a thing. Tough love
tougher
sometimes.
Family
but
dynamic,
but,
sure.
But great. But she's also very supportive of what I did.
Right.
And she saw that I was down there practicing, and one day she saw a sign downtown that said there was a DJ competition, and she said, Paul, I saw a sign for a DJ competition. She said, you should go in it. And I think she had seen that we were watching these videotapes of these competitions and really like getting excited. And I was like, oh, mom, like, no, I'm not ready. She's like, what? She's like,
of course you are.
She wasn't like, you're good. She was just like, well, you seem to be pretty serious about this. So like, why don't you go into this competition? And I was like, oh man, you know. And at that point, you know, if your mother is calling you a wussy or something, you
know? Well, and that, I know exactly what you're talking about, because my mom right after I'd done some traveling suggested I go to this broadcasting school and, mm-hmm. and this multimedia course, and it was very everybody was trying to get into it. Mm-hmm. It was a big thing out in mm-hmm. Victoria, but you know, her suggesting I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mom.
I know, right? Yeah.
But it was like great. I mean, I was so glad I did it. I'm glad she pushed me.
I stepped back and then I did it. And I entered the competition. And that I competed against Buck 65 and a couple other locals. Buck won that battle.
He did?
Yeah.
He's pretty fancy on the tables.
Yeah, absolutely.
People maybe don't totally know that about him. But I saw him in Vancouver. The two of us flew out to record CBC.
Scratch, man.
And I watched him work. He did a good job.
Yeah, great DJ. And going in that, and being this new kid that everyone was like, who is this kid? I think I was 16 at the time. And,
fresh-faced.
You know, my mom took me in, and like, I remember my mom, like, you know, she's like, I don't even, like, the building was like over capacity. And she's like, I don't even want to go in there. You can go in there. I'll wait outside. Let me know when you're done.
She must, I wish she was a little worried when she had decided, okay, what have I sent my son to?
Yeah, exactly. But not, kind of, sort of, but like, I came third place in that. And then from that, I got.
That's a big support, right?
Absolutely.
You just sort of feel like, okay,
I got a little bronze spray painted 45 medal on a ribbon.
Sure.
The competition was called the DJ Olympics. Right. They had hip hop section, house section, and drum and bass section, three different competitions. And I came third in that, and I just got a bunch of numbers. Like, I got Buck's number. I got this guy 6'2", who lives in Toronto now, Gordsky, and a few other people that I looked up to locally, and I would hit them up and I'd say, hey, like, what are you doing this weekend? Can I come? Can we practice? Can we try scratching?
And your dad was, as you said earlier, too, a
music guy.
Yeah, he was a music guy. Mm-hmm. So that was all kind of there.
Yeah.
Was mom into music too?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Mom always danced into music. I mean, coming from the islands, she had her island tunes, and she would move to her.
Well, that's interesting, because I've noticed, even you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like even some of your more recent material, mm-hmm. you are working with a lot of reggae, and I'm hearing old ska and old soul. And, I mean, we'll talk about classical in a minute, but you do feel like you're working a lot with that material.
Yeah, and part of that's moving to Toronto.
Right.
I moved to Toronto 10 years ago, and there's not a lot of Caribbean people out in Nova Scotia, so my experience with Caribbean culture was mostly in the house and relatives, and so I'd know what my mom played, different Mighty Sparrow, or like, you know, the Dollar Wine, the hot, like, kind of classic stuff and steel pan stuff, and but it was kind of just through her, the collection and our family get together songs. And she had cousins and people that were pretty serious about recording. Like, they would record mini discs of live pan sessions in Trinidad, and they would play it for me. And that, I learned from that musical obsession, but also sort of like, that was, they brought that with them, and that's what reminded them of where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of like, it's limited a bit to just family. Whereas when I moved to Toronto, it's just Caribbean culture is everywhere around here, especially out at the clubs and parties. I had these reggae songs and stuff that I liked, and when I played them, sometimes they're the biggest tune of the night.
Right.
And it was like, oh wow, cool. This is really fun to have this around. And then of course, as a DJ, a record collector, I'm digging through collections here, and there's so much island music here. It's crazy.
I will say that since I got Sirius Satellite Radio, which I use sparingly, mm-hmm. I like to mix it up and mm-hmm. listen to terrestrial and my own stuff and podcasts and mm-hmm. everything. So mm-hmm. I jump around. But I will say that the joint, the reggae.
Yeah,
channel,
it's a great station.
I can leave it there for like a week.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
For sure. You know? It's a great station.
Yeah.
I love
that music.
Yeah, it's a really deep music. And I think like from an outsider's perspective, sometimes you think it all sounds the same or something. But once you get into it, yeah. There's so much. It's a wealth of music. And I've really in the last little bit gotten really into it.
You're listening to a remix edition of Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Paul Murphy, DJ Scratch Bastard, continues in a moment. You're listening to the Zoomer Podcast Network. Let's get back to Art at the End of the World. And if you have followed Paul's career, or if you know anything about a famous DJ in this world, they do a lot of traveling. And Paul's done a lot of traveling. He's seen the world. He's on his way to Russia later this year. He was just in Asia, Las Vegas, all over Canada, all over the States. So when it comes to the loose theme of this show, discussing artistry and reflecting on cultural change, I wanted to start with that idea of travel.
You've worked with so many different types of music, and you've traveled much of the world with your work. And when you think about that Halifax kid, you know, just getting started, what's changed when it comes to understanding people and engaging with a crowd and having a meaningful artistic moment mm-hmm. with an audience? Mm-hmm. Because you have so much more perspective now just because of the experience you've had in the world. You've seen a lot of the world.
Absolutely. And before we get into it, I that is the greatest thing that music brought me, is just this perspective on the world. I still remember the first time I left Nova Scotia. Well, first time I went overseas was 2001, and I've been traveling all over since then, and it's totally changed my perspective on people. You bring up a really good question, and I think it's hitting all the right notes. I'm endlessly inspired by things I see when I travel and what I can bring to people, and when I come back, and how I feel when I come back and see things that locally feel, sometimes I feel distant from local stuff when I come back, you know. Sure. Sometimes I'm inspired by everywhere I go. I think always in a net good way. But sometimes you go somewhere and say, oh, this is not the way we should do things. And sometimes you go somewhere and say, this is the way we should be doing things. Uh-huh. And, when I was over in Thailand just now,
I mean, that's big. That's like a world away.
Yeah, it is absolutely a world away. It's very far away.
Yeah.
And you get there, and there is lots of global influence. But when you're there and you meet people there and you talk to them about their lives, and they're not as financially motivated. They're more motivated by doing good things. Of course, their finances play a part in it, but there's this element of doing the right things for the right reasons. And when things are so much cheaper, it's not this rush to get all the money because you don't need it all.
It's
just not there.
Yeah.
And some of these places you go and there people are eating in the alleys, like you go and you're eating cheap, but they're eating for next to nothing. But that's what all they need, kind of, sort of. But then you said, then there's this kind of global influence on it. And then you're like, well, I mean, it's a heavy subject, really.
It is a heavy subject. And you come back here, and I hear this all the time, you know, whether it be just walking in a grocery store that's super loaded with food or what have you, it can be sort of shocking to reassess how we live here.
Yeah, and then the prices of it, how it got there. Yeah. Like our generation, too, it's like food. Like my generation, we are a few generations removed from the people that grew lots of their own food. We're the supermarket kids. Yeah. Like, I didn't think twice about where those things came from.
Me neither.
When I was born. Yeah. Like, and now you look at the sticker, says product of Mexico, you don't think about how it got there.
Right?
That's interesting that we're a product of that society, and there's always advertising that's always trying, not, it doesn't tell you that that's where it's from. It's just like, go eat this delicious thing, put it in your mouth and enjoy it, and then buy it again, you know? Like, and then you don't think of the chain of effects that that has so many different places around the world. Another thing that just popped in my head is like traffic.
Right.
You know, we have a super advanced highway road system here, and everyone honking and road rage and this and stuff. And you're just like, and people have this idea of this projected space. Like, so he cut me off.
Right.
But you weren't there. It wasn't your space. So someone else got in your projected space, the place you were going to.
Yeah.
You know what? In other countries, they don't have that. That space isn't there.
I remember speaking to the fellow who runs the Toronto Tabla Ensemble, and he was telling me that he got a real kick out of that.
Yeah.
That exact idea. Because in India, you would never, ever even consider that notion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just, they live
the driving's way crazier and way less honking. And, and it's sort of like, it's almost like we have so few problems that we make the problems,
right?
You know? And so traveling via music has really helped me be more grateful for what I got and not to get so worked up about some of these small things.
People perceive this cultural moment as a moment of crisis. I know sometimes I get caught up in that. But when I talk to people who perform a lot and travel a lot and have to be in that forum and that space, they often sort of see a more positive version of people and culture.
Yeah.
Because they are exposed to people's everyday realities in all sorts of different places.
And different places that have gone through crazy stuff and different places that are going through different stuff. And it's a lot of our perception too, because like I go to places and it's funny, there'd be people that don't travel much and like people say things like, oh, like be careful and stuff. You're like, no, I don't have to be careful going here or something. Like, I get it, but don't project your fears on me, you know? And just going to these places where people think it's, you know, dangerous or scary, and this is just kind of what's been pumped at them through media to keep them at home and keep them here spending money and just like a hamster in the wheel, you know? It's like people let this stuff get to them and these implant these own prejudices and these own walls, like these own boundaries in their head that they don't even realize, like, they're cutting themselves off from a lot. And these kind of conveniences being these modern conveniences, not realizing how much conveniences can tie you down. And like, you don't really need that stuff, but you feel like you need these things. And you're like even food, you know, I've learned from traveling, you try to eat what the locals eat. And I have a very open palate and I love it. But a lot of people travel and they want to find McDonald's or something like that.
What they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
You think that this work and this travel and this life has changed your perspective?
Absolutely, like and it wasn't
pretty fundamental.
It wasn't like I want to be a traveling DJ. I didn't really think about seeing the world because I started when I was like traveling when I was like 18 or 19, and I just hadn't fully processed that thought of traveling and seeing the world.
Yeah.
But then I started to, and then you know, the first time you land in England and they're like, oh, they're driving on this other side of the road, and then you go get the thing. And then, oh, the Skittles.
That's a good starter point.
Yeah. The Skittles taste different over here, you know?
Different chocolate bars. Yeah, I used to love them.
Right, I know. But that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Sure is. You know? that's more of the 13, 14-year-old excitement.
Yeah,
I remember going to the States and seeing different types of chips and things and going, wow, this is great.
Yeah, and again, tip of the iceberg, cause there's so much. The more you do it, the deeper you get, and the more you see and take it. And obviously, the world is continuing to evolve
And I love, I think I could connect the two dots here that with your experience, that's, you can hear it in your music too.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, you really, when you listen to your earlier stuff compared to now, there's a bigger world going on.
For sure. And you travel and you hear these sounds, and it's funny. And I bring back that thing about building those walls in your brain and the prejudices and stuff. And sometimes you don't realize it, but music can be appropriated or just thrown at you in this sort of thematic image that you're not really processing what's actually going on with the instruments being played. It's like packaged to you in this image and style. And like Latin music, for instance, it's like, it's always like the images of in movies are a lot of times tied to moments in a club with like women dancing or something, or like a moment in a certain part of town. But like, you don't actually process what they're doing with the instruments sometimes. And Indian music, similar stuff. And I find sometimes that things have been so, you don't realize how much you're judging things before you actually do. Like, and sometimes I get it from people requesting stuff to me, or like someone says, this sounds pretty Mexican. I'm like, what? Like, what do you mean?
Like, no kidding.
Yeah, have you been to Mexico? Have you been to Spain? Like, have you been to Colombia?
Enjoy your life. Yeah, yeah. What's wrong with you?
It's sure. funny that we, and we don't even know that we're doing it, right? Yeah. When I say we, just culturally, that people are doing that. A lot of that is like breaking down my boundaries and saying, oh, this is just really cool music. You can like a certain type of music without separating it from an image. It's just music, and music is just a crazy never-ending conversation that's just flown all over the world.
So let me ask you about this. All right, so there it is, Scratch Bastard with the Afiar Quartet Spin Cycle, and there's a couple tracks in that world. So that goes to a little bit what you're talking about. There's you playing around with classical music.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Thank you.
When I heard that piece, I thought, what is he doing now?
Yeah. Well, that was a great opportunity for me to step into that world. And the classical world can be a little heavily guarded in its direction,
and maybe even sonically tricky to play with
on it some is level. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so just some background into it. What you're hearing is a project called Spin Cycle, and we called it Spin Cycle. The concept was brought to me by the leader of the Afiar Quartet, Adrian Fung, and he wanted to do like a remix project that was a bit more of a conversation rather than just sort of, a lot of times with the remix, the conversation ends at the remix.
Sure.
Like he would pass the stuff off to me to be remixed. But what he wanted to do was start with the music, hand it off to me to remix it, and then bring it back so that we could both collaborate on like a third entity, which would be like kind of like the remix of the remix. And I really liked the idea. I thought that was a cool way to do it. I didn't know how we were going to do it exactly, but I was, you know, sign me up. And they gave me the four pieces that were written by Canadian composers, and they said, okay, here they are. I was like, okay, how are we going to do this? And I was like, can I bring you guys into my studio? I come from a sampling background. When I hear a cool part of a song that catches my ear, I want to loop it up. I want to put hard drums over it. And I want to like bob my head to it. Yeah. And that's it. But like, with this project, I was like, okay, well, that's not going to be enough, because like this world isn't just going to get off on just a nice loop. I got to make songs. And so it was a challenge.
I bet it was.
But it was.
I feel like I can hear your hard work in that. Okay. Those
well, thank yeah. you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hope hard work sounds good.
Yeah.
But it was an awesome experience.
Yeah.
It was challenging, very challenging. And there were times where like deadlines would come and go, and I'd be like, okay, I'm coming. I can almost do it. And I was like, it's almost finished. It's like, you know, those last few strokes are sometimes the hardest ones of the painting.
Yeah.
But thrilled with how it came out. So I brought them into the studio. I said, I want you guys to help me replay these parts. I kind of separated some of them. I was like, okay, I don't want the whole quartet to play these. Isolate these instruments and give them to me to use as my toolkit. Because like I said, I need music. I can't just make... I need pre-recorded stuff.
It speaks to an idea that I was thinking about earlier, which is, you know, you're talking about getting them in there and having a bit of that live feel, but also being a producer. I mean, you do have to wear a couple different hats a lot of the time. Yeah. Like the way you are, if people look at your new video from Taipei, that's a pretty heavy-duty live experience. But if people hear what you produced with Rich or this or that sort of idea, that really is a different set of muscles.
Yeah, for sure. And as a musical artist, and we talked about Bowie, if you look back on Bowie's discography, the one red line through everything is just David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's worked with so many different artists, producers, sounds, and he's just, it's kind of what speaks to him. And surely his world experiences have spoken to him too. For me, I'm always interested in finding new sounds and cool music, and interested in applying this art form to anything, anything that I think is valid, anything that sounds like a good place to apply it.
Do you think that makes you more open than some DJs out there?
Yeah, I think so. But I don't think I was always like that either. I think traveling has helped that. And I think, you know, growing up has helped that.
Yeah.
Like I look, you know, I think we all look back at some things that we used to say in our teens or early 20s and say, that was a little...
It's a freaking nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little tough. That was, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that, speaking on that, in this kind of new world we live in and everything, I feel a little bad for some kids growing up today.
I do
because
too. Yeah.
Because and but
you're not going to catch a break.
You're not going to catch a break. And so what that pushes them to do is to not express themselves,
right.
or to talk in less letters and words because they don't want to have anything to be misinterpreted and stuff like that. And you know, I think we need to give the kids a break.
It's very thoughtful, very insightful, I think. So since we're working our way through CBC, former CBC hosts or current CBC hosts, let's talk about Shad for a moment because you've done some amazing work with him.
It's just like that as we and we out here. Luxurious limoncellos, what we bout here. Tahiti violet vibrations, no doubt here. Celebrations and salutations, and we out here.
I met Shad in London, Ontario, where he's from, at a show. I was DJing for a rapper named Josh Martinez, and this guy Shad was on the bill, and Josh said, hey, have you heard of this guy Shad? I was like, no, I haven't heard of him. He's like, yeah, he's great. Like, he raps, he plays a bit of the guitar, but not in a corny way, you know, and he's just a really dope rapper. And I saw the show, and I was instantly impressed. I was like, wow, this guy's really good.
He's really good. He's so identifiable. That's what I love about him. He's got such a great, like, he has a voice, like an artistic voice.
Yeah, for sure. And we connected there. It was a nice guy. I don't even know if we traded numbers or anything like that, but like, just okay, cool. Mental note, there's a guy in London that's really dope. A couple of years later, maybe even later that year, I saw this video he did called The Old Prince Still Lives at Home, which was a take on Fresh Prince, like the Fresh Prince
of Bel-Air.
Yeah, Bel-Air.
Right.
Of Parents Just Don't Understand, the video. And it was great. And like, oh man, and like, not only was it cool and like cool looking and a cool reference, the actual rap was amazing. Like, this guy's a very talented rapper.
Great writer.
And, yeah. And then, so, you know, okay, cool. Shad's doing cool things. I forget if I reached out to him then. But later, maybe another, fast forward another year or two, and he put out this tune called Yeah, I Get It. And I just remember, like, watching this video and being like, okay, this guy is really stepping into, like, another realm of, like, this guy's becoming one of the greats, in my opinion. Like,
sure.
I was just really connecting with what he was saying, how he was saying it, and just, like, the energy that he had. So, chance meeting, I think I reached out to him on email, or I think it was a chance meeting actually out in Vancouver when he was living out there. I was like, oh man, we got to get together. I really like your stuff. Can I play you some beats? And played him some beats, and I had a beat kicking around that he wanted to use, and we recorded a song called Give You All I Can. And that year he won the Juno. He beat Drake or whatever, and he's like, hey man, he's like, I want to release this song now, and I think it fits as a good celebratory song for winning the Juno. So I was like, let it fly.
Yeah.
And he put it out, and I was super happy with how it turned out. And we made some more music, worked on his next album Flying Colors together. I produced 5 or 6 songs on there.
Yeah,
and we just, you know, we just kept working together after that. Did a little EP called The Spring Up, and now we just collaborate on stuff. He's one of my best friends, and just a great musical collaborator, an amazing person. And I think, like, an underestimated, I wouldn't call him undervalued, because I think those that know.
I don't think so either. And I think even just this sort of two legs of his tour that he's doing right now, I mean, it feels really solid, and it feels like as a guy who's just, like, entrenched in the culture.
Yeah, I think once you're a fan of Shad, you'll never not be a fan of Shad. He's a hard guy to leave.
And he was so great coming out at your gig at Kerner. You guys just came out and really killed it.
Yeah, it so fun. Yeah, that we performed Limoncello, which was a song that we made for fun one day.
Yeah.
And it turned out really good. And
funny how that works.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we weren't even trying to make a song, really, kind of. We're like, let's go in the studio and see what happens. And we made that song in like 2 days. Let's just, like, send it. We printed it. We pressed a 45. And then we performed as well Stylin', which was off of Flying Colors featuring Socrates, which is a record I produced as well.
Socrates, another classic Canadian voice.
Yeah, Toronto, classic Toronto MC.
I should point out the Scribble Jam, because I think that, I assume that's an important point in your
for
career.
Sure.
15 years ago or so, was it the game changer that I imagine?
I think it's like 17 or 18 years ago. Crazy. Yeah.
That's why I said or so.
Yeah.
that means 2 to 3 years.
Okay. That was at Scribble Jam, which was in Cincinnati, which was a underground hip-hop festival for the Midwest. And, I mean, this is where guys like Eminem went to battle.
I was about to say, he's the first guy that pops into your brain when you say Midwest rap battles.
Yeah, it was a proving grounds for that stuff. So, I mean, when you watch 8 Mile, it's not far off from what the scene was there. I don't know if it was directly influenced, but that was definitely the type of culture.
So when you're walking into that at that moment, you've been around the block at that point, but still.
Well, I first heard about it from Buck. They had gone down, and him and 6-2 as the Sebutones, they went down and performed there in 2000, and they came back and they said, oh man, like, this was the most amazing festival. It had an MC battle, a DJ battle, a b-boy battle, a graffiti expo. It was like, that's so hip-hop, and like the showcase, the artists playing and everything. They're like, it was the best week of my life or something like that. I was I gotta go, you know. And so I decided, okay, I'm gonna go, and pulled together with a couple of my friends, Josh Martinez, one of the guys I met, chatted with, and a couple, we were like, okay, we want to go. They were like, some of them were like, we're going to enter the MC battle. And I was like, I'm going to enter the DJ battle. So I brought like 10 records to enter the DJ battle. And I did. And I ended up doing pretty good and making it to the semifinal. Then in the semifinal, I faced this guy that I'd heard of from Texas. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to get by this guy. But I had this routine with Buck 65's records called The Centaur, which I actually had used on him at a local battle before.
You used his own music against him?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Did he know you were going to do that?
No. But
he must have sort of appreciated it.
Well, he put out his record. I think he probably saw me pulling it out and then like...
Oh boy.
Yeah. And he's like, this better be good. And it was. And
yeah.
I flipped it into the Star Wars, the Imperial Death March, and it worked really well. And it worked good there. And I thought, because Buck had a bit of a following down there, maybe it would connect in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And it did. And so I did this routine where I turned Buck 65, the Centaur, into the Imperial Death March. And it got captured on video, and I actually didn't end up winning the whole battle. That was just the semifinal, and that was I was just like, I got to get this out there.
Right.
And I lost in the final, but that semifinal round, and this is kind of like, it ended up getting on the internet, like the pre-YouTube internet. We're talking like College Humor and like E-Bombs World and like websites where video was hosted before YouTube.
Right.
Hard to imagine a world like that, but people started hitting me up saying, hey, I saw your video on College Humor. I saw your video on this website. Is this you? And I'm like, yeah, that's the Star Wars. And it would say Star Wars DJ. That's all it would say. You know, it wouldn't even say my DJ name.
You take the fame where you can find it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But again, like to bring it back to the Bowie video or something like that, like at first when that was around, I was like, yeah, of course my video is up there. I'm dope. Like, they should have a video of me up there. They should have a video of me on it. I'm making myself out to be more cocky than I was. But, you know, I took it for granted a little bit. But then after a little while, I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing that this video has helped me make a name for myself all over the place. And so I started taking videos a little more seriously.
I want to pick up on something you pointed out too, because you mentioned that it's a routine and that obviously a lot of practice goes into deciding how you're going to mix from record to record, you know, almost to the point of real precision decisions. I just saw that
precision
show.
Precision decisions, I like it.
I saw that show, Free Solo, which you may have heard about. We got the guy who climbs mountains without ropes.
Yeah.
It's all the rage right now. It is an amazing film. But, you know, much like your craft, you know, he practices it like a million times before, with ropes, before he ever
takes them off.
Yeah, and takes them off and makes that decision. He knows exactly, inch by inch, exactly what he's going to have to do to make this happen.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're kind of living in that world a little bit too, that as you go between record to record and you map out a routine.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
There's a bit of instinct too, of course.
There is. And I think that I truthfully can't compare myself to that guy, because I instantly got like chills thinking about climbing Mount Everest without ropes on.
Right.
And I think I draw a little bit more from just a jazz improv and that kind of thing. And just this whole kind of thing about, you'll always find a way. There's no bad notes. You'll always find a way out of it.
Right.
But you have to be prepared.
You do.
There is a level of preparation with DJing, because I need music. I need to have a loaded clip. I need to have stuff.
Yeah.
I can't just blow out of a mouthpiece and have something happen. I have to have the proper music or notes at my disposal. So
it's like learning the script of a play or a film. You memorize it, then you kind of forget it.
Yeah. Because they want to hear the natural line.
That's right.
They don't want to hear you read it.
Yeah.
And it's something like that for sure. And I think that I just got good at, I would say earlier in my career, I might have thought the way that you were describing it, like, okay, everything's got to be on point. But what happens then is, like, once one little thing is
goes off the rails,
it will go off,
right, without fail.
Yeah, you can get off your track. But if you kind of stay a little bit more ready and not rely too much on it being exactly like it's supposed to be, I think you can make this own sort of like momentous magic. Like, people there can get it. And if something messes up, people kind of can see that it messes it up, but the recovery can bring you even greater heights.
Yeah.
I feel like.
And all the more joy.
Everyone loves a good recovery.
I mean, even like a band like, and I probably reference them way too often, but even a band like the Grateful Dead is a good example. I mean, there's a band who uses improv as their one of their main tools.
Yeah.
And they screw up all the time.
Yeah,
they're famous for their screw-ups.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But the way they get themselves out of it is not only enjoyable, but sometimes hilarious.
And yeah,
sometimes
exactly.
It can be all kinds of reasons.
And then everyone that's present there says, I was there when they did this.
Yeah. Found their way out of this jam. Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to. It's like, for me as a performing artist, it's not so much about me. It's just about us and the moment and us all
energy.
Being there. Energy, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm always reinterpreting stuff and remixing stuff and changing sounds. And that's what I was talking about, where it's like watching it happen is part of the fun and making that connection. And if it's too rigid or too planned out and I make it look too scripted, I feel like it takes away from that experience a bit.
What's your take on Deadmau5?
Well, I have a couple Deadmau5 songs in my computer.
Yeah.
I think
another Canadian guy who's, you know, kind of taking on the world.
Yeah.
You know?
To be honest, like, his music is not totally my cup of tea,
right.
But I do respect it. It's very well produced.
Yeah.
And he's a very skilled producer, but stylistically, it's not really the music that gets me going.
You don't want to have fast cars like him.
You know, I've never been much of a car guy, I gotta be honest. I drive a Volkswagen Golf.
I think that pretty much says it all. Right. All right. Really, really great to hang out with you today. I learned a lot, and you're an amazing performer.
Man, thank you. I mean, I appreciate the good questions and digging deeper. There's a lot to it.
There he goes. DJ Scratch Bastard, great guy. Great conversation. Very, just a nice fella. Love talking to him. And Paul will be in Vancouver next week at the Red Bull Freestyle National Finals. And then he's headed to Russia in April for a big competition in Moscow. I think 5 nights there. And then, of all places, he'll be in Prince Edward County, Picton, Ontario, in May. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Crow's Theatre. Great show on stage right now, Secret Life of a Mother, and Red Eye Media. If you are looking for representation as an artist or as an arts organization, Red Eye Media, a great place to go. Thanks to you as well. Thank you for checking out the show. You can always send me a note. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. We're back on Monday here on Art at the End of the World with a very special episode, especially if you listen to the New Classical FM regularly. Actress, voiceover artist, TV host, author, musician, and host of Nocturne on the New Classical FM, Marilyn Lightstone, will be my guest. We'll speak to you then, and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.